In this inside story, you will hear that stalking is not a legal term.
Stalking is a behavior, and like any complex human behavior, there are many different underlying causes.
We'll get inside the mind of a stalker.
That initiates this sort of over-the-top clinging behavior, this almost childlike behavior of trying to possess the object and not let it leave.
We'll learn about different types of stalkers, and we'll learn how police have changed the way they operate to try and recognize and arrest stalkers.
Let's look at what really is going on here, and that's that this victim is being harassed and stalked.
In this inside story, you'll find out why policing bodies from across the province gathered for a two-day seminar at the Solicitor General's College to learn about stalking and how the law, from the arresting officer to the lawyers and the judges, can use little-known existing laws to help put an end to the stalking behavior and to save the victim from torment and, in some cases, death. Oh, can't you see? You belong to me. Sting and the rock band The Police sang it, but Richard Beck believed it to be true in his case. Richard, or Dick as he was referred to, thought his wife of more than three decades belonged to him. And if he could no longer possess Karen, no one else would. Karen Beck would be killed by her husband Dick in their family home in the Vancouver suburb of Maple Ridge in November of 2007. Dick would then take his own life after setting fire to the house, destroying all that there was left in their lives. Theirs was a case of control and manipulation. Domestic abuse, but not physical violence. One of far too many thousands of cases that falls under the category of stalking behavior or increasingly criminal harassment in our country. Adam Frisch and Darlene Dorchak are Karen Beck's brother and sister. I met with Adam and Darlene to learn a little more about Karen and her life with Dick. They tell me that Karen and Dick first met when Karen was 15, and they married by the time she was 17. This courtship and marriage would nearly span four decades, until June of 2005, when Karen left the marriage. Darlene and Adam say they now know that Karen suffered mental abuse for many, many years, but that Karen held it to herself. If it's a secret, hide it, and maybe it'll go away. But in June of 2005, Karen gave up her secret, and Darlene says once she started talking, Karen didn't stop.
Dick was always a very strong personality, let's say. And there was always that element that we saw in him that we thought, that's a little bit strong. You know, should somebody really be that controlling? But we never really thought about it because Karen never really talked that much about it.
Can you think of it, for instance, like it was Christmas dinner and he said this or anything that...
Yeah, as a matter of fact, when we were camping, and we decided to go camping, kind of a mini family reunion, and there was some food during dinner, and Karen didn't want it, and he insisted that she eat it. So she had to sit there and eat the food that he said she had to eat. Now, this was, at this time, like a 40-some-odd-year-old woman being told by her husband in front of her family, you will finish that on your plate.
As far as Adam and Darlene know, Dick never hit Karen. There was never any physical violence before her death.
One of the things that Dick was very famous for was, and this is something, again, we learned after, was if there was a family get-together and if Karen didn't act appropriately, quote-unquote, when they got home, Dick would keep her up. Like, even if she went to bed and had just fallen asleep, he would wake her up and keep her up for, like, days at a time, not allowing her to go to sleep. And
what?
I know. It was just absolutely crazy. And to the point where, you know, okay, now you will do what I want you to do. And he would just yell at her and badger her and whatever. Never, ever hit her. Never, ever. But
that was the thing that really worked against Karen. and works against a lot of women or individuals in those circumstances, because we recognize that domestic violence isn't just against women, it's against men as well. So victims in those cases where there isn't physical abuse works against them, because it's my word against yours when you go to the police, when you go to the authorities, and when you're talking to family or friends, they go, "What? We've never seen you with a bruise. You know, show me some marks. And what did you do that caused that?"
"Yeah, but he doesn't drink. He doesn't hit you. What's the problem?"
Darlene calls it the spider web of trying to help get Karen past this. How can she get help? Darlene says that Karen went for help, but she couldn't articulate her fears and her cries went ununderstood by police. Like what?
"He had a knife, and it was an 18-inch knife. Right? Point, you know, stem to stern knife. And he sent her a card saying, 'You are 18 inches from heaven.' And she took the card to the police and said, 'This is what it means.' And the police said, 'So you feel threatened?' And she said, 'Yes.' But he didn't actually say that he was going to hurt her or do anything with this knife. It was 18 inches from heaven. So the police went, picked up the knife, and her son was there, her youngest son. And he said to the police, like, 'Okay, you're taking the knife. Aren't you going to do anything about this?' And said, 'Well, you know, until he makes his move, there's nothing we can do.'"
Yeah, and that was one of the questions that we asked after the murder-suicide. Okay, he's made his move. Now what? Now what are you going to do?
I'm at the Alberta Solicitor General's College in Edmonton to learn more about a law called criminal harassment. Sounds pretty dry, I know, but if you've been listening to this Inside Story up until now, you'll know it's anything but dry. This law is a tool that many are hoping more and more police agencies will consider using when they're faced with domestic abuse and stalking behavior cases. One of the presenters at the seminar is Calgary Police Detective Jeff Anderson. Peppered throughout his lecture, Detective Anderson includes popular songs like this one by Human League. Why do you play those songs?
I just play them to just keep people mindful of what they're listening to, what they're hearing, and how, like you said earlier, we normalize the behavior. And often people confuse those songs for songs of love and worship, but really they're songs just about obsession and really about criminal behavior where there's someone stalking someone. And I think it's kind of a fun way, a light way to bring it to light. And then it brings awareness, because everybody listens to the radio in their cars. And when they're listening to these songs, they can now cue into it. Sometimes people accuse me of ruining the radio for them, but I laugh and I say, well, at least now you're aware of what we're listening to. I wanna push you down.
The experts in this Inside Story use a term that's quite applicable to stalking behavior, and that word is creepy. Something didn't feel right. The victim may not fear for his or her safety, but something is just creepy. Detective Anderson says, trust your instincts.
What we advise all our victims to do is stop any and all contact whatsoever. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult, but the more you talk to your offender, the more it encourages him. Even if it is telling him to stop, and even if you are yelling profanities and getting angry with him, and you think you're very clear in how you want him to stop, all that does is it encourages the behavior. If you pick up the phone after the 50th time he calls and yell at him, then he's just learning he's got to call you at least 50 times for you to get to answer the phone. So we tell victims, stop any and all contact, get the police involved, so that we can start monitoring the behavior, get him charged, get some good solid conditions on him. I would improve your home security, make people aware, make people
around. Tell people at work so they know?
Tell people at work, yeah. Often people want to hide this stuff because they're embarrassed, but people need to make others aware, because often when you go back and you talk to neighbors and coworkers and friends of people, they have seen the behavior. They have seen the guy hanging around. They have seen the guy sitting down the block in his car, just didn't know who he was or why he was doing that. But once they're told, then they can be allies for you. And they can watch out for you and report things to police so we can build a good, strong case.
Crown Attorney Val Campbell is now the director of RTAMI, the Alberta Relationship Threat Assessment Management Initiative, a province-wide umbrella group dedicated to threat assessment for high-risk domestic violence and stalking cases.
Are some more dangerous than the other? For example, somebody sees you on the TV news or something like that and they want to follow you around or leave phone messages versus the husband or boyfriend or wife that you jilted?
The most serious kind of stalker, the one that's most likely to become violent, is the intimate partner stalker.
The relationship is ending. The abuser is losing that power and control, and he tries to get it back.
And he tries to get it back. One of the ways is through the conduct that becomes obsessive, following, watching, threatening, engaging in conduct that causes that person to fear so they'll come back. They're trying to get back that power and control.
That's what happened when Karen Beck tried to end her 30-plus year marriage to her husband Dick. After decades of controlling behavior, Karen's brother Adam and sister Darlene say she had had enough.
Like, she wasn't allowed to watch TV, she wasn't allowed to listen to the radio, she wasn't allowed to go and talk to people unless he knew who they were and pretty much that he was with. But anyway, it came down to it that he had said to her, you will write a letter saying that sign a letter stating that I am above God. Because all Karen had left was her Bible. That was all she had left. And she would sit and read her Bible for hours and hours. So when he took her Bible away, it was now to the point where he wanted her to sign this letter. And she looked down the barrel of this gun, and her words to me was, "Dar, I can smell the bullet." That's how close it was. And she knew that if she signed this letter, that was it. She was done anyway. So she just said no. She had the pen in her hand and she put the pen down and said no. Because either way, it was a death to her. Either she signed the letter saying that her husband was above God, or he would kill her. And she thought, I would rather he kill me. At least I know I will go to God.
Darlene says Karen went to police and they did help her in finding a safe place to stay at a woman's shelter. They also followed up at the family home and asked Dick if he in fact had a gun. Dick admitted that he owned a gun, but he denied ever threatening Karen with it. He told police Karen was just nuts. Police left the home and never called Dick in for questioning. Once Karen had gone into hiding once and for all in June of 2005, she finally started to reach out to her brother and her sister and to the rest of the family.
I mean, I swear, like, she would talk to me for 2 hours, talk to him for 2 hours. And, you know, and so every night we'd just talk and talk and talk. And then she would just let it out and out. And the more you heard, the more you go, like, you know, we didn't need to see bruises. We didn't need to have anything on paper saying, this is a fact, this is what happened. All we needed was Karen to say was, you know, this is what's happened. I'm in a shelter. I need help.
But Karen wouldn't be the only one reaching out to her family. So was her estranged husband, Dick. Dick would warn Darlene not to phone their aging mother, who lived in the same Vancouver suburb as Karen and Dick. And he begged her to tell him where Karen was hiding. Darlene says she told Dick she thought Karen was in Victoria to send him searching in the wrong direction. And that's the last time she ever spoke to Dick.
He was extremely hurt, and at that point that was when he threatened me and said, first I will take her and then I will come and get you. So even after he had died, it wasn't, you know, because it was murder-suicide, I made Adam go to his funeral and go and make sure he was dead, because I was terrified it wasn't him. And mm-hmm. You know, because every day you were never sure if he was going to come to your house.
Now, this is one of the issues that one might tend to overlook in a case of stalking behavior and domestic abuse. Karen and victims like her can go into hiding, but their friends and entire family members can't. Dick threatened Karen's family, and if he couldn't find her, he still knew where they lived. Crown Attorney Val Campbell, now the director of ARTAMI, the Alberta Relationship Threat Assessment Management Initiative, says for so long now, the law has been blindly oblivious to the dangers of intimate stalking and abuse.
Stalking is a precursor to domestic violence homicide, so we really pay attention to it. If somebody's engaging in really serious stalking behavior, we pay attention to it. And extraordinary types of behavior, such as renting cars to avoid detection. So if it's an estranged spouse, we've had cases where the spouse has rented cars to avoid detection, has, surreptitiously put a device on her telephone so he could hear her conversations, and this type of thing. In that particular case, it ended up in a murder. She was murdered. And in Canadian law, actually, if an estranged partner kills his or her partner, and it can be shown that that person was stalking their partner before they killed them, it's first-degree murder, irrespective of planning and deliberation.
Why didn't we put the stalker in jail before he killed her?
That is exactly the goal.
The goal is to have all of police trained in criminal harassment law, and that's also part of the challenge. Individual occurrences without a witness are just that. But to be able to add up all of this conduct, investigate, and build the case. Now, this has more weight in a court of law and certainly does not focus on one response, but the entirety of the relationship. So by recording all of the creepy interactions, saving the emails and the phone messages, having others also involved by reporting and recording suspicious activity helps to report an established pattern. And through our TAMI, police are being better trained and are given better tools on what to look for and what kinds of questions they should ask.
So there's 19 very well-known risk assessment questions that we're asking frontline police to gather from domestic violence incident.
Can you give me one or two of the questions?
Yes, there'll be is separation pending or has it occurred? Because separation is the number one risk factor for lethality in domestic violence cases. So it'd be history of abuse, separation, access to weapons, any suicidal or homicidal ideations, threats to harm, threats with a weapon, forced sex, biting, strangulation, choking, those sorts of things we ask about.
This all sounds like common sense to me, but this is the law we're talking about.
We know statistically that a victim will be battered many times before she actually picks up the phone to call police, for example. So that is critical. We know that likely this is the first incident when the police arrive the first time. Not likely. There's probably something going on or has been something going on in the background in the past, and we need to know what that is and how severe it is, and is the conduct that's occurred in the past, is that the known red flag risk factors that we know?